Brother Arthur, brethren and sisters, and young people. In our last class, we concluded around verses 16 and 17. And we left the theme of verse 17 somewhat incomplete, but with the intention that this evening we would take it up by looking particularly at the reference to the Old Testament quotation from Habakkuk chapter 2. Before we turn to that, though, we must just remind ourselves of the principal theme which has now been introduced here in verse 16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth. That word believe is going to become a very significant word, not only in our study of Romans, but in our whole lives. Our young ones will recall from our study of Elpis Israel that Brother Thomas said that the greatest thing that a man can do to honour God is to believe him, and consequently to show that belief in action. But the first thing is to believe. And that, of course, is the greatest thing we can do to honour anybody. If someone tells us something and we believe them, that means we trust that person. But if we are of a suspicious disposition, an unbelieving disposition, or feel we can't trust the person, then we perhaps don't believe them. We are not really honouring that person, are we? And that's what the Apostle Paul is here saying, that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to people who are simply prepared to believe God. And whilst that's not the be-all and end-all of it, belief is nevertheless perhaps the most important of all of the principles, to believe God. And as he goes on to say, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed, arising out of that faith or belief, unto a faith or belief which is manifested in what Paul styles earlier on, the obedience of faith. And so it's this concept now of the righteousness of God. The righteousness of God in the first instance is his character. But his character now, as revealed unto us in the wonderful gospel message embodied in the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, means that the righteousness of God can be extended to other people. It can be extended to people who are prepared to believe. Now that's the background of what we dealt with in the latter section of our class last time. But to emphasise the point, the Apostle says in verse 17, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith, that is, out of faith, out of a faith which stems from a belief in the first instance, unto faith, a faith which is manifested in obedience. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. And so the question which we left at the end of the class was, why did the Apostle Paul quote from the book of Habakkuk? For those who may have had perhaps an opportunity to look through the notes that were handed out at the last class, you'll remember that there was a few pages of notes there on the book of Habakkuk. They didn't deal specifically with the relationship between Habakkuk and Romans. It was simply a set of Bible marking notes on Habakkuk. Well, perhaps many of us have marked up Habakkuk. Maybe we've marked them up in similar words to what we've seen in those notes. But the question now is, can we see the connection between Habakkuk and Romans? Some will tell us, well, in fact, Paul quotes Habakkuk 2 on three occasions. He quotes it here in Romans chapter 1. He also quotes it in Galatians chapter 3. And he also quotes it in Hebrews chapter 10. So as far as the apostle was concerned, he saw Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 4 as a very, very powerful verse. The just shall live by faith. Let's broaden our question for a moment. Let's try and answer the question in general terms. Not only why did he quote it in Romans, but why did he quote it in Romans, Galatians and Hebrews? Have those three epistles all got something in common which necessitated a quote from Habakkuk? Well, perhaps if we can answer in the first instance what those three particular epistles have in common, we might find ourselves in an easier position to be able to answer the significance of the quote from Habakkuk. The problem in Romans, the problem in Galatians, and the problem in writing to the Hebrews was very much predominantly the problem of Judaism, more so than in any of the other epistles. In fact, one might almost say that they were the three great epistles which had to deal with the problem of Judaism. Now, Judaism is going to be a real issue, particularly when we come to chapter 2. But Judaism is only just one aspect of the manifestation of the flesh. The Jews elevated the flesh essentially by claiming their abstinence from evil. The Gentiles, on the other hand, elevated the flesh by their indulgence in that which we would call evil, but they would simply call the natural outworking of human nature. And so you've got those two aspects. You can either elevate the flesh by abstinence and being proud of your abstinence and claiming righteousness because of your abstinence. That's Judaism. Or, if you'd like to take one of the Gentile philosophies, it's Stoicism. On the other hand, one can elevate the flesh by Epicureanism, by indulgence. And we're going to find in Romans chapter 1, from verse 18 to the end, Paul deals with the problem of the Gentiles. And then when we go into chapter 2, he's going to deal with the problem of the Jews. And whilst these two problems seem almost diametrically opposite, they both had the one thing in common. They elevated the flesh. Now, no one is ever going to live by elevating the flesh, whether by abstinence or by indulgence. Those things in themselves do not make people righteous. And I hope our young people don't get the wrong idea. Abstinence is a good thing. We should abstain from evil. But abstinence in itself does not automatically make us righteous. And we've got no grounds for feeling proud of our abstinence. All right, well, that's a bit of a brief overview of those three epistles. Galatians, of course, was the problem of Judaism, and Hebrews was the fact that here were Jews who'd accepted Christ wanting to go back to the law. Well, what's the connection with Habakkuk? Perhaps you might like just to have a glance at the notes on Habakkuk, found from, say, page 6 onwards. As we glance through the notes on Habakkuk, we find here that there's a discussion going on. And in the first four verses of Habakkuk chapter 1, Habakkuk had a complaint. In fact, we probably ought to turn over to Habakkuk as well. In those opening verses of Habakkuk, Habakkuk had a complaint about the way in which Yahweh appeared to be tolerating the evil which was prevalent in the midst of the Jewish community. And he complained about the wickedness which abounded on every hand. We see it there in those opening verses. Verse 2. O Yahweh, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? You see, he says the Jewish people are wicked. Verse 4. The law is slack, and judgment doth never go forth. So Habakkuk looked out upon the community of the Jewish people at that time, and he could see that they were not living up to the principles of the truth, and he demanded that God should do something about it. Well, in verses 5 to 11, he gets an answer. And in verses 5 to 11, Yahweh says, I'm going to work a work. In fact, we see it there in verse 5. Behold ye among the nations, and regard, and wonder marvellously. For I will work a work in your days which you will not believe. Just note that. Habakkuk, you're not going to believe what I'm going to tell you. Believe, you know, faith, belief, same word. I'm going to tell you something, Habakkuk, which you're not going to believe. Do you know what I'm going to do, Habakkuk? I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans. And I'm going to cause the Chaldeans to punish my people Israel. Because as you've rightly noted, Habakkuk, those people are wicked. They've got to be punished. And I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans to punish them. And then Habakkuk says, oh, no, that's not right. You can't do that. Because the Chaldeans are more wicked than the Jews. And Yahweh says, yes, well, I told you weren't going to believe me. So Habakkuk then proceeds to argue with God. He had difficulty in reconciling the righteousness of God in such an act, because he considered that the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, were more sinful than Israel. And so then in verses 12 to 17, he puts forward that argument. So see the situation then of Habakkuk chapter 1. The first four verses, Habakkuk says, the Jewish people are wicked, Yahweh should do something about them. Verses 5 to 11, Yahweh says, I'm going to do something about them, but you're not going to believe what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans to punish them. And Habakkuk says, I can't accept that. It doesn't seem right to me, because the Chaldeans are more wicked than the Jews. Did we know of another prophet that had a similar sort of problem? Yes, Jonah did, didn't he, really? Jonah was a patriotic Israelite, wasn't he? And the reason that Jonah fled to Tarshish was not because he was frightened to go to Nineveh. As he says within the context of the book, he said, I knew that if I went to Nineveh, they'd be converted, and I didn't want them to be converted. Why didn't Jonah want them to be converted? Because God was going to use the Assyrian to punish an earlier generation. So just as the burden of Jonah was that Jonah was to preach to the Ninevites, that the Ninevites might be converted, because Yahweh was going to use the Ninevites to punish Israel, so a later generation sees Habakkuk say, I can't accept the fact that Yahweh is going to raise up the Babylonians to punish the Jewish people. So there was a similar problem. But when we get to the end of chapter 1, Habakkuk says, well, look, I'm not going to argue with God. I can't understand the rightness, if you like, the righteousness of what he's doing. But as we come into chapter 2, he says, well, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say in me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. Those words aren't all that easy to understand in the King James Version. We might notice from our notes there that the notes don't particularly pick up the translation, but there is a slightly different rendering there, which you can pick up from the margin. That's where it is, in the margin of the King James Version there. He says, I will stand upon my watch, set me upon the tower, and watch to see what he will say unto me, or as it is rendered, in me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved, or when I'm argued with. In other words, I'm prepared for Yahweh to argue with me and to convince me that I'm wrong. And so Yahweh answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. He may run that readeth it. I'd like to read you that just from the New International Version, which is very good on that. Some people think that I think this is very good on everything currently, but it is. It's quite a good translation, really, in bringing up the idiom of language, which is sometimes a bit difficult to understand from the King James Version. Habakkuk chapter 2 says, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Then Yahweh replied, write down the vision and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. In other words, the message is going to go out as from a herald. For the revelation waits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright. But the righteous will live by his faith. Now, that's the expression which we have in Romans, the just will live by faith. Now, in general terms then, the book of Habakkuk is this. Here are wicked Jews. God is going to raise up Gentiles to punish those Jews. Habakkuk says that's not right. But the problem was Habakkuk didn't see the end of the vision. Because what God was then going to go on and say was, but I am then going to punish the Gentiles. So punishment will be to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. Where have you heard those words before? It'll be to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. And then after that, as Habakkuk chapter 3 shows, I will then bring blessings upon Israel, and then upon the Gentiles. So the theme of the book of Habakkuk can be summarised in these words. Punishment to the Jew first, then to the Gentile, subsequent blessings to the Jew first, and then extended to the Gentile. And that, after all, is what the promises to Abraham are all about. In thee, Abraham, the father of the Jews, shall all nations be blessed. And so this concept of to the Jew first, and then to the Gentile, becomes actually the theme of all of Romans chapter 1 and chapter 2, and it crops up again consistently throughout the book. So with that as a background, let's go over to Romans then and see if we can pick up the way in which Paul is actually quoting a whole context from the book of Habakkuk. If we can simply then remember in our minds that the theme of the book of Habakkuk is punishment upon the Jews, subsequent punishment upon the Gentiles, blessing upon the Jews, and then blessing upon the Gentiles. Now, in the midst of all this, here was Habakkuk. And he was, you might say, like a typical individual, a typical Jew saying, but I don't understand why this should happen. He didn't understand the righteousness of God at that stage. He had to learn that the just, the righteous, will live on the basis of their belief or faith. And that regardless of what is going to happen to Jews and Gentiles as a whole, there are individuals who are standing aside from all of this, and they will live for eternity on the basis of their faith in that gospel message. Now, what's the situation in the days of Rome? In the days of Rome, we've got this situation, don't we? Haven't we? In the period of the gospel writings, we have the Lord Jesus Christ telling the community of Jewish people that they are going to be punished, that God is going to bring upon them the Romans, and the Romans are going to punish them for their wickedness. The average Jew at that time couldn't understand that. They couldn't understand how they, as the custodians of the law — that's the point that Paul brings out in Romans 2. He says, you Jews think you are righteous because the law has been spoken to you. And you assume that because you have received the law, you must automatically be righteous. They probably thought that they got the law because they were righteous in the first instance. That was the Jewish thinking. The Lord Jesus Christ is telling them in the Olivet prophecy, you're going to be punished. And God's going to bring his armies against you, the armies of Rome, the armies of Messiah. But Rome, in turn, like all of those Gentiles down to the Russians, will ultimately be destroyed. But then Israel shall be saved. And that becomes the theme later on of Romans 11. And then, when Israel is saved, Romans 11 points out that the blessings will then be extended to the Gentiles as well. Now let's see how already in Romans 1 and 2, Paul is laying the basis of this sort of argument. In Romans chapter 1, we've just read it, but let's read it again now and see the significance here. Verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth. Now, who did it come to first? It came to the Jew first, and then to the Gentile. Paul's going to show that both Jew and Gentile had departed from God's way. Therefore, God's punishments would be poured out in just that same order, to the Jew first, and to the Gentile. And so if we come across to chapter 2 and verse 9, let's start it from verse 8 to get the flow of the argument. But unto them that are contentious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that doeth evil, of the Jew first and also of the Gentile. So the gospel had come to the Jew first and then to the Gentile. Both Jew and Gentile had departed from the way of God. Therefore, God's wrath would be poured out upon them, to the Jew first and then to the Gentile. But, he says, and you see, that's parallel, isn't it, to Habakkuk chapter 1. The wrath of God being poured out on the Jew first, and then Habakkuk chapter 2, the Gentile next. But Habakkuk chapter 3 says, but glory will ultimately be manifested to the Jew and then to the Gentile. And so Romans 2 goes on to say, verse 10, but glory, honour and peace to every man that worketh good, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile, for there is no respect of persons with God. Now, I said last class, if you remember, I only wanted to spend about 10 minutes on this tonight, so I don't want to spend any more. We could, of course, do an exhaustive study of Habakkuk, but it would get us, you know, really away from the major theme of Romans. What I want to submit to those who perhaps haven't thought very deeply in terms of the use of Old Testament quotes is this, that this is the sort of exercise that we can do every time we come across an Old Testament quote. We will do it occasionally through our study of Romans, particularly in Romans 3 and 4, where Psalm 51 and Psalm 32 are quoted very powerfully. But we won't do it on every other occasion, because it will just take too long. But the idea is that when we find a verse, we go back to the book that it comes from, and the first thing we say is, what's the theme of that book all about? And more often than not, in fact, we might say probably in every case, The New Testament writer is giving us an insight into the theme of that book. But of course, there might be several themes in that book, and different writers might pick up different themes. So what then has Paul picked up for us out of the book of Habakkuk? Paul has picked up out of the book of Habakkuk that no one can be proud of their ancestry or proud of any of their achievements. Whether they're a Jew or a Gentile, it doesn't matter. God is no respecter of persons. You might say, well, then what advantage has the Jew? Well, that's a good question, because that's how Romans 3 starts. And we'll answer that when we come there. He says, what advantage then has the Jew? Well, let's not worry about chapter 3 at the moment. Let's see the problem. And we are still establishing what the basic problem is. The problem is this, that the Gentiles had departed from God's way by indulgence in the flesh. The Jews themselves were no better, but they boasted in the fact that they were Jews. And God says, well, in that case, the gospel came to the Jew first, then to the Gentile, in which case punishment will be to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. But when God's glory is revealed in the earth, it will be revealed first in the Jew and in the Gentile. But all mankind ultimately has a hope. It is simply that there is an order in this. Now, of course, what we are doing is we are tending to rush forward a little bit, and we are trying to pick up themes as they come. We don't want to get too deeply involved in those themes by anticipation, but it is good to see just where we're heading through these first two chapters. Well, having then said in verse 17 of the chapter that the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith, we leave that theme for a moment, and only for a moment, because the theme of the righteousness of God is going to become the dominant theme of chapters 3 and 4. But when we come to verse 18, and you might notice, and if you happen to be on page 12 of the notes, you'll be able to follow fairly closely what I'm saying, because those are the notes that I'm working to, that in this particular section, which goes from verses 18 to 32, Paul, under the general heading of man's failure to attain to righteousness, is going to look first of all at the failure of the Gentiles. He's going to look at the failure of the Gentiles, so that verse 18 reads, "For the wrath of God is revealed." Now you see, that's really set in what we might call juxtaposition. It's set against what we read in verse 17. Verse 17 says, "For the righteousness of God is revealed." Verse 18 says, "For the wrath of God is revealed." So here's two manifestations. A manifestation of the righteousness of God, revealed unto those who live by faith, but a manifestation, a revelation, of the wrath of God against those, well, let's read the verse, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness." What I would like to just point out at this stage, and I think this is very important that we should get this picture, otherwise we will find Paul's reasoning here a little difficult to follow. Verse 18 is the verse that we've just read. Verse 18 makes a certain announcement. We have to see verses 19 and 20 as being, like in brackets, explaining what verse 18 is about. And then verse 21, you have to imagine the rest of the page, through to verse 31, being an illustration of verses 19 and 20. And then verse 32, coming back and finishing the sentence which started in verse 18. I thought I had a transparency with page 200, but I didn't for some reason. If I did, I left it somewhere. But if we were to go across the page, and you see how I've coloured this in, and I've done the same in my Bible here, a red line, for example, against verse 18, a blue line against verses 19 and 20 indicate that they are an explanation of verse 18. Verses 21 to 31, which I've coloured in yellow, being an illustration of verses 19 and 20, and then verse 32 would be coloured in red because it is the completion of the sentence. Let's just read verses 18 and 32 to see what it's really saying. Verse 18 and verse 32. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. Now, that's what he wants to say. And if we can see it as being simply like that, verses 18 and 32 are a statement, but it's a very, very profound statement. And you'll see it there in the notes on page 32. We've endeavoured to set it out sort of staggered like that. You see, just part the way down the page, we read that the structure of the argument in verses 18 to 32 can be understood if the verses are bracketed. That is, that verse 18 expresses the fact that God's wrath is manifested against man's unrighteousness. Verses 19 and 20 are in brackets, explaining verse 18. Verses 21 to 31 are in brackets to describe the terrible declension, the terrible decline that followed the rejection of God, while verse 32 returns and completes the thought commenced in verse 18. So I think it's important we bear that in mind as we're going through here. We'll do this on several occasions in the book of Romans because there is a reasoned argument going through. And if we can follow the reasoned argument, well, of course, we can follow what the book is about. Where our attention now is directed to the manifestation of the wrath of God. You might say in some ways our subject tonight is a negative one. It is my intention to get right through to verse 32 tonight because I don't see any point in dwelling on many of the verses there which simply illustrate the wickedness of the Gentiles. God's wrath is to be poured out, but we must understand that God's wrath is part of his divine character. Let's come to grips then first of all with verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Now, I don't think there's much difficulty in understanding the first part of that verse. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against ungodliness and unrighteousness. But it's the last phrase which is very, very misleading in the King James Version. Who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Now, how can people hold the truth in unrighteousness? And I'm going to suggest that this is a key expression to our understanding of the argument. I'm saying that every 5 minutes that there are key expressions, but they are. There are key expressions because the AV tends to obscure what is being said there. Now, in your mind, what do you understand by people who hold the truth in unrighteousness? Do we mean then that there are people who've come to a knowledge of the gospel, they've learned that truth, but they don't live up to that truth, therefore they are holding the truth in unrighteousness? I think that would be a reasonable assumption to say that that's what that verse is talking about. If that's what it's talking about, and it's not, then it becomes very difficult to understand what Paul is talking about in the rest of the chapter, in fact, almost in the rest of the book. Let's look at our note here, because I think we might just as well read this. You see the word hold, who hold the truth. The word hold in the Greek is katecho or kateko or something like that. It means to hold down or suppress. Now, of course, when we think about the word hold, we usually assume it means to hold up. We just automatically assume that. If someone says here, hold this, it doesn't usually mean hold it down, it means hold it up. If you want them to hold it down, you say here, hold this down. Now, to hold down something means to suppress it. So the first thing we notice is that here are some people who are holding down the truth. They are suppressing the truth. A comment from Brother Carter's book is this: the cause of wrath is the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. Just come down to the bottom of that verse and see our NIV translation. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. So the first thing we notice is it's not people here who are holding the truth, it's now a group of people who are suppressing the truth. Now our next question is, what is the truth that they are suppressing? Is it what we commonly call the truth with a capital T? And the answer is no. Let's read on. And we go back a few lines to where we left off a moment ago at the end of Brother Carter's comment. No, it's not the end of his comment, it's only halfway through it. The truth, with a small t, suppressed, is not the system of doctrine which we usually denominate the truth, and we'll call it with a capital T, but as the context shows, it means a more general knowledge of God. Just a general knowledge of God. Paul explains in verses 19 and 20 that the power and divinity of God are clearly seen from the creation of the world, man by this being without excuse. Paul's going to argue that anybody who simply examines what they can see in creation has ample evidence before them to recognise that there is there a divine hand. And in fact, Paul is going to suggest, in a way which might be an interesting thought for some of us, we may never have thought this before, there is sufficient evidence in creation itself for man to at least be able to live a life of restraint and kindness towards his neighbour. He may not know the gospel of salvation, but there is no excuse for man to live the way of life which seems to have just exploded, even in 1987, as Brother Arthur has said to us, a way of life which is not in any way spiritual, it's not in any way even natural. It is completely unnatural. And that's what we are seeing in the world today. And that's what Paul is going to deal with here. Man is without excuse. There is no excuse for man to act in the way that he's acting today. It's totally against even nature. Now, this is the truth that he's going to be speaking about here. The comment goes on to say, and this is no longer Brother Carter's comment, the man who suppresses this truth by his own misconduct is further described in verse 32, you know, that's the counterpart, the end of that comment, as one who not only does things worthy of death, but consents with those who do. Now, here's the point. I have said, that here in verse 18, the verse is actually telling us that the wrath of God is going to be poured out upon people who suppress the truth about God by the wicked way in which they live. He's not speaking about people in the ecclesia. He's speaking about the Gentile world out there, who sometimes we say, well, of course, they're ignorant. They don't know the way of God. They are just living the way of life that they know. No, says God. Many of those people are living a way of life which they know themselves on the very basis of the law of nature is wrong. Therefore, there is no excuse whatsoever for them to live that sort of life. They may not know the gospel, but there is no excuse for them to live the way they do, because nature itself provides ample evidence of that fact. Thanks for that quote, Michael. Michael quoted from Acts chapter 14, verses 15 to 17, and I won't reread them again, but for those who weren't able to hear it, those are the verses that he quoted, which he suggests are an explanation of this. They are. In fact, whilst there is no harm in going to Acts 14 and other quotations as well, verses 19 and 20, of course, serve the same purpose. And the intention of these two verses now is to illustrate that very point. So see why we were saying, well, you perhaps can't see it yet, but anyway, that's what we're going to see, that verses 19 and 20 are going to prove to us that our interpretation of verse 18 is what it should be. In fact, it might be just as easy now to read those verses and then read the comment in the, or refer to the comment in the notes about them. Verses 19 and 20. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, and I'm reading, of course, from the NIV at the moment, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So the truth, which is referred to therefore in verse 18, the truth which is being suppressed, is not the truth of the gospel. Those people don't even know that. It is simply the truth that there is a God, and that even the God of the natural world, the God who has created this natural world, has given us sufficient evidence for anybody who is prepared to open their minds to say there must be a God. And the very principles of creation will demand of me that I lead a way of life which is in conformity with that natural creation. But these people had gone beyond that. They weren't even prepared to live a life which was in conformity with the principles which they'd seen. So as we said, these two verses then, verses 19 and 20, are an explanation of verse 18. When we read there, that which may be known of God, see there in verse 19, because that which may be known of God suggests to us that natural creation reveals the existence of God and many of his attributes, such as his power, his wisdom, and his justice. Although creation in itself does not reveal the details of his purpose, which of course can alone be found from the Word, it does reveal sufficient about God to leave man with no excuse for living a life of wickedness, such as described in verses 21 to 31, which we have now come to. And so Paul is going to show the way in which man degenerated. Whilst in verses 21 to 31 there are details of many sins which Paul in another place says, let them not be once named among you, the reason I believe why he has listed them here has been principally to show the degeneration which starts from a simple source and ends up with the ultimate of what he describes as a reprobate or depraved mind. And it can all start from simple beginnings. He's writing to an ecclesia to warn them that they are human beings like all of those animals which were there in the city of Rome at that time. And the potential is for any one of us to end up like that if we start off the wrong way from simple beginnings. Let's allow Paul to tell us this himself. So as we come now to verses 21 to 31, he's going to illustrate the degeneration which took place to show that the Gentiles deserved the judgment that God was going to pour out upon them. In verse 21 we read, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. The verse which starts off saying, because that when they knew God, it's better rendered, for although they knew God. They knew God? No, they didn't know the gospel, but they knew there was a God. Let's be honest, as far as those people outside are concerned, or let's, shall we say, call them to be honest. I don't think there are very many people that deep down generally believe in absolute evolution and that there is no divine power. They want to believe it because it suits them. It suits them to believe it. Evolution, of course, started off with Charles Darwin's doctrine of the survival of the fittest. When I say it started off, it's existed in previous generations. Even back in the days of the Greeks, there were those who believed in evolution. But the modern evolution was Charles Darwin, survival of the fittest. That was put into practice by Hitler. And he put it into a national practice. And he was going to prove that the Aryan races were the fittest, and to prove that, they would destroy the Jews. So what started off as simply a philosophy became a way of life and was put into practice. So the basis of evolution is here. If you can get rid of a God, then you can get rid of those restrictions which are upon you. And so he's going to show to us here that there were people that knew God existed. They knew he existed. They could see it from creation about them. That's why the there's a group of people who are really quite weak, and they go for theistic evolution, and they say, well, I'm prepared to believe in a God, but I believe he set in motion a course of evolution, so whichever's true, I've got to be right, and I can't be wrong totally. I can't be completely right, I can't be completely wrong. Well, that's just a dishonest evolutionist, really. But here were people now that really knew there was a God, but they glorified him not as God. The answer is, they were not thankful. That's where the problem started. And of course, we really spent quite some time on that. I think it was in the last class. If it wasn't the last class, it was the one before. The lack of thankfulness is the basis, really, of all of the problems in society today. When man ceases to be thankful for what he's got, then he becomes greedy, and he wants more. More of what? More of the flesh? More of indulgence in the things of the flesh, because he's not thankful. More of materialism. He wants more of everything. And when he's got it, he's still not satisfied, and he wants more and more and more. And so it was a lack of thankfulness. Now that is the sort of thing that any one of us could actually be susceptible to, couldn't we? Very easy to become unthankful. We've got everything to be thankful for. Our ecclesia, the word of truth, the great hope which is before us. And yet sometimes when our minds turn inwardly, we start to think, well, I've got a lot of things to be unthankful for. And we start listing down the things I've got to be unthankful for, and they sometimes seem in our mind to be greater than the things we've got to be thankful for. Well, it's not quantity we're talking about, it's quality we're talking about. And when we think that we've got the hope of salvation, then I don't know how many other things you could build up in life to be unthankful for that could anywhere measure up to that in any shape or form. So unthankfulness is a very, very dangerous thing. Discontentedness, always wanting more, looking across the fence and seeing that the neighbour's got something better than what we've got, and wanting that. That's, of course, what the world's on about today, isn't it? And so Paul says it started with unthankfulness, and it ended up with a depraved mind. And he's going to show to us how they degenerated through these particular stages. And because they were without excuse, because there was no excuse for them to deny that there was a divine power, then God's wrath was rightly to be poured out upon them. The fact that they didn't know the gospel has really nothing to do with it. He's going to show to us that what the gospel does is it gives greater responsibility to those people. They are under more responsibility. In fact, of course, in terms of at least Christadelphian jargon, we would say they are responsible. The other people may not be responsible to God, but they're still going to experience his wrath. Because although they may not have believed the gospel, they are without excuse for living a way of life which they have done. And so we simply note there that the word thankful was covered in our previous consideration of verse 8. He comments in verse 21 that we're just looking at the moment, they became vain. The word vain means to be futile or empty. Romans chapter 8 and verse 20 says, the creation was made subject to vanity. It was as a result of the transgression that a way of life was opened up, that man, if he left to himself, would ultimately lead a life of uselessness and emptiness, which we see, of course, in the community in which is about us at the moment. So that they became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Verse 22 says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And of course, this was the characteristics of the Gentile world. They prided themselves in their wisdom. But let's see how verses 22 and 23 present to us this picture. They became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God. Now, you can't actually change the glory of the incorruptible God. The word is better rendered exchanged. You can't change God's glory. In fact, once again, we'll read from the quote which we've got in the notes there. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man, and birds, and animals, and reptiles. Note that decline. There was the worship of God which was offered to them. They declined from a worship of God to a worshipping of man, and then finally degenerating through various stages of animals until you get to the lowest form of life, the creeping thing, or the reptile as it is in the NIV. So appropriate, because we're right back to the Garden of Eden, and it was the serpent, of course, in the Garden of Eden which represented the ultimate in degeneration as far as the thinking of the flesh is concerned. Now he says that's what man has done. He has exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God. Now at this moment he's basically only talking about that glory which you can see in nature. There is no excuse for anybody in this life to lead the way of life which is described here in the latter part of chapter 1. No excuse whatsoever. They know it is wrong. They don't know the truth. They don't know the gospel, but they know it's wrong. And that's why he says in verse 20, at the end of verse 20, they are without excuse. So here's what they've done. They've exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, birds, four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Now what does God do when man makes up his mind that that's what he's going to do? It might even apply to brethren and sisters of Christ who get to the stage of saying, well look, I am going to do what I want to do. At what point does God cease to restrain them any longer? Well, that's a decision which God makes. And in his wisdom, he acts in a way which our mind cannot totally comprehend. But we do know that for those who put their trust in him, those who beseech in prayer that God will guide them in life, that God will put those restraining influences there if we ask him. We ask him to help us along the way to the kingdom. That means that every now and again, God's got to put a blockage in our path. How do we react to that blockage? Because the blockages aren't usually very pleasant. When you run into a brick wall, it hurts. When you trip over something, it hurts. So we ask God to help us, so he restrains us. But if we keep knocking those restraints out of the way, as though they shouldn't be there, sooner or later God says, well, okay, I'm not going to restrain you any longer. And that's why we are going to read three times now in this chapter, God gave them up. He ceased to restrain them. And there were three things that he gave them up to. Verse 24 says he gave them up to uncleanness. Verse 26 says he gave them up unto vile affections. And verse 28 says he gave them up to a reprobate or a depraved mind. And so here it was, a natural deterioration. It commenced with something as simple as a lack of thankfulness. The lack of thankfulness led to idolatry. God therefore says, I'm going to give you up. And progressively they went from a stage of uncleanness to vile affections to a depraved mind. And if you want to know what those things mean, then they are clearly illustrated there as you can read them. And all of those things are seen in the society which exists at the end of an age before God's judgments are poured out. We understand they were there in the days of Noah. They were there in the days of Lot. They were obviously there in the days of Paul, and certainly evident in Rome. And one would expect to see them in even a greater manifestation at the end of Gentile times. And I suppose 10 or 15 years ago when we read that chapter, we thought, well, it will probably be a little bit different today. It won't be quite like that, I wouldn't imagine. The world couldn't quite get to that sort of stage because people are more civilized today. And it is happening at such an accelerating rate that I think all of us are quite shocked and startled by the sort of things that we are hearing, even if we don't get a daily paper, and even if we very rarely listen to the news. One can't move in society today without hearing these things not only being explained and excused, but really justified. And isn't that what verse 32 says? Who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. And constantly we are being told that governments of the world are not trying to change morality in society. They are only trying to alleviate or overcome to a limited extent the problems which society is creating for itself by indulging in the very way of life which is explicitly and specifically outlined here in Romans chapter 1, in which he quite clearly says, for example, in the latter part of verse 27, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. And so here is a society which is going to degenerate not only mentally and morally, but actually physically, as a result, of course, of the things that God has given them up to. I'm not going to stop you any longer, he says. If that's what you want, that's what I will give you. There is an interesting comment here in the notes, which we find about halfway down page 24 and 25, which says, God gave them up. And as we've mentioned, this God gave them up occurs three times. He abandoned them because they were unwilling to retain God in their knowledge and chose to worship idols. He ceased to restrain them and suffered them to act out their sentiments and manifest them in their lives. I have a quote here, and whenever I've got a quote in italics, it means that it's somebody else wrote it, and I put it down because I rather liked it. Bear in mind that the notes you've got here are essentially notes which are for me to talk from. So if you say, well, they're not really readable notes, well, that's unfortunate. They're meant to be talkable notes. And I like to know whether I'm quoting somebody else. So somebody else said this, and that's why I put it down that way. But I thought it was a good comment. It is implied in this statement, one, that the tendency of man was to these sins. So you see, if God gives somebody up, what he's saying is, all right, I won't stop you. And you know, if you're holding on to anything, you might be walking your dog, and it might be a fairly strong dog or a horse, and you let it go, then that horse or dog or whatever takes off in the direction that it wanted to go anyway, and you cease to restrain it. So if God gives them up and says, right, I'm not going to restrain you any longer, it's implying then that the tendency of man was naturally towards these things. Secondly, the tendency of idolatry was to promote them. So first of all, in your heart you want to do them. Then you create some form of idolatrous worship which will promote it. Therefore, all that was needed for man to commit them was for God to leave him to follow the devices and desires of his own heart. Note the words of Psalm 81 verse 12, which the psalmist many years earlier had expressed as being the same thing the Apostle Paul is saying here. Psalm 81 and verse 12, and it's speaking here about the people of Israel. But people are people, whether they're Jews or Gentiles. And so Psalm 81 verse 12 says, so I gave them up unto their own heart's lust, and they walked in their own counsels. So the heart of man left to itself has no limit to the depravity in which it will indulge itself. But there is no excuse. The individual cannot blame God for it, because when the individual looks out upon even nature itself, he sees plenty of evidence there to recognise that that way of life cannot be excused. And so he gave them up, as we see here, unto uncleanness, which means impurity, either physical or moral. He gave them up unto vile affections. It can mean shameful lusts. He gave them up to a reprobate or a depraved mind. Thus, there is a natural and obvious deterioration, commencing with something as simple as a lack of thankfulness, leading to idolatry, and ending with a depraved mind. And so verse 25 tells us that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And again, we see the need on quite a few occasions here to look at other translations, because verse 25 says, they changed the truth of God into a lie. Now, you can't change God's truth into a lie, but you can personally exchange it. You can say, all right, here's God's truth. I'll change it for something else. I don't want that. I'll exchange it. So they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. So be it. And so that's what they've done. The world today worships not the Creator, but the created things. Isn't that so simple? They worship the money which they earn. They worship the possessions which they acquire from that money. They worship the indulgence of the flesh. They worship all things which are created. They don't worship the Creator. And there's no excuse for them not recognising the divine hand. And so, having exchanged the glory of God for idols, they then exchanged the truth of his existence and Godhead for a lie. And by denying that he exists, they are no longer under an obligation to conform to the moral standards which his justice requires. That's a good statement. I didn't write that one either. But it's not in italics, but I didn't read it from book either. So you can work out if you like how it came. But I think that's a very good statement. Having exchanged, can't you work it out? Well, I won't explain it to you. Having exchanged the glory of God for idols, they then exchanged the truth of his existence. You see, that's what the world's doing today. It's saying, well, there isn't a God. It's a lie. They know there is a God deep down, but they'll say, no, we don't want a God. They exchanged the truth of his existence and Godhead for a lie by denying that he exists. No, that creation out there isn't creation, that's evolution. By denying that he exists, they are no longer under an obligation to conform to the moral standards which his justice requires. And you notice there, we're just simply saying his justice. We're not saying anything about the gospel. We're not raising it to that level yet. We are talking about the Gentile world out there who don't know the gospel, but from the very evidence of the natural creation, they are without excuse. So God's justice requires their obedience to a way of life which they know to be right. Paul concludes that point by saying that they worshipped the creature more than the Creator, who is to be praised forever. And the very use of the word amen there, it's a Hebrew word denoting strong affirmation. So let it be. It implies here the solemn assent of the writer to what was just said, or his strong wish that what he had said might be, that the name of God might be esteemed and be blessed forever. And so we come to the second of, for this cause, verse 26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections. And so, having given them up in verse 24 to uncleanness, they changed the truth of God into a lie, they dishonoured their bodies. Now verse 26 says, the next thing is vile affections, and God's no longer restraining them. He could have restrained them, but they didn't want to be restrained. So he gave them up a second time. He gave them up unto vile affections, unto what has been otherwise translated to shameful lusts. He says, for this cause. Well, what was the cause? Well, the cause is that which he has just said. They didn't glorify him as God. They were unthankful. They became idolaters. And he says, if that's what you want, that's what I will give you. And then we come in verse 28 to the third of the God gave them up. Brother Carter makes a comment in his book that there is an interesting play upon words in this verse, which is not preserved either in the Authorised or the Revised Version, but which brings home the warning. Because they cast out the knowledge of God, God gave them an outcast mind. And that doesn't come over too well in the English, but in the Greek there was a play upon the words. Because they had cast out God, God cast them out. He gave them a mind which was a cast out, a reprobate, a depraved mind. And so in verses 29, 30 and 31, he lists off those sins there which are the ultimate form of degeneration of a mind which has rejected God, not just rejected the gospel of God, but totally rejected God, being filled with all unrighteousness, says verse 29, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable and unmerciful. That's the world. If you were to momentarily cast your mind back to Habakkuk, virtually the whole of Habakkuk chapter 2 gives us a description of how bad the Chaldeans were. The Chaldeans were like that. They were fierce and they were vicious people. And God was going to use them to punish Israel. But you see, he's talking about here, about the Roman world. And yet God was going to use these very Romans in the very near future to punish Israel and destroy Jerusalem. And you can imagine people like Habakkuk saying, well, look, the Lord Jesus Christ said that the armies of Rome are going to destroy Jerusalem. But the armies of Rome are made up of people like this. God can't use these sort of people. That was the argument of Habakkuk. And wouldn't there have been people like Habakkuk in those days saying, I can't make sense out of this. Where is the righteousness of God? Paul says the righteousness of God is revealed out of faith, unto faith, to those who are prepared to believe. To believe in something higher than all these things, to believe in the gospel. Habakkuk was told, you're not going to believe me, Habakkuk. But Habakkuk made it in his mind he would. And he said, well, look, I can't understand it now, but I'm going to stand and I'm going to watch. And when God argues with me and reproves me, I will learn something. And what did he learn? He learned that the righteous live by faith. And you see, whilst we've spoken tonight about that wicked world out there, we've got to get rid of this as fast as we can. There's a group of people who are trying to live by faith. They want nothing to do with that world. They want to be thankful. Thankfulness will set them on that course. Thanklessness could well end them up in this situation which we see here. And it can happen, and it does happen. And we are shocked and startled when we see it happening. When we people that we know and recognise are prepared to do this sort of thing. Where does it start? At what stage did they go wrong? Are there some of us here this evening that are actually on this course, unknowing to ourselves? I suggest, brethren and sisters, that once again this aspect of thankfulness is so important. The positive side was that Paul was thankful for the brethren and sisters, thankful for the truth. But he says there's people out there that are no longer thankful for anything in life. And this is the way they end up. And so we come then to that last verse, verse 32, which is the sequel then to verse 18. Who knowing the judgments of God. Now even that is not a good translation, because it's not saying that these people here know that there is going to be a day of judgment. It's not saying that at all. They probably don't know anything about a day of judgment. They don't know the gospel as such. I mean, some of them may do, but we're assuming that by and large these Gentiles didn't know it. That the Gentiles had a moral sense or were capable of knowing the will of God in this case is that which is clear, particularly when we read chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. We read there, for when the Gentiles, which have not law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or excusing one another. He's saying there are Gentiles who live to the principles of the law, even though they don't know what that law is. They live a right life. No, not a right life under salvation, but they live a right life in the sense of doing what they believe is right by their neighbour. They think it's a wonderful world, they believe there is a wonderful power behind it all, and they believe that there is a wonderful way to live. And there are people in the world who are trying to do that. You and I probably know some. They're not impressed by the truth, but they're not living a depraved way of life here because they know it's wrong. And the people living the depraved way of life also know that it's wrong. There's no doubt about that. So the Gentiles had a moral sense. They were capable of knowing the will of God in this case, as it is clear from chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. The means which they had of arriving at the knowledge of God were their own reason, their conscience, and an observation of the effects of the depravity which they could see about them. And are you finding men and women in your contact today that are absolutely horrified at the depraved world that are about them? They're not really interested in the truth with a capital T, but they are shocked at the depravity of the world around them. And they are trying in their own way to bring up their family in a proper way. They don't seem to want to talk about the truth, but they do believe in a truth, that there is a power of morality which exists in the world. And Paul says there are such people as that. But he was talking about the ultimate result then, of people who have given up and ceased to believe the fact that there is such a power in the world. That word judgment, though, is worth commenting on there in verse 32, because it's not the normal word for judgment, which is crisis or something like that. It's the Greek word zakoma, which means a just deed, a statute or a decision. Vine defines the word as an ordinance in this place. That is, what God has declared to be right, referring to his decree of retribution. And the same word occurs in these other places which are listed here. In fact, in Revelation 15 verse 4 and 19 verse 8, the word is translated as the righteous acts of the saints. So there's the expression, it's righteous acts. Now come back to verse 32. Who knowing the righteous acts of God, they know that there is a God who deals rightly, righteously. Nevertheless, despite that knowledge, they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. And so the apostle brings that section of his case to a close, having explained that the Gentile world is absolutely without excuse, that the righteousness of God has been revealed in the earth, and mankind at large has rejected it. He's now in chapter 2 going to look at another class who have likewise rejected it but don't believe they have. And maybe that will come a little closer to home, because here are Jews who are boasting in the fact that they are Jews, but he says they are no better than the Gentiles. Let us then, with what has been predominantly a negative outline of characteristics that we don't want to be seen amongst us, and we don't want to mix with in the world, nevertheless extract the one positive lesson that comes out above all of this, and that is that if we are to set our lives along a course of action which is going to lead to the manifestation of the righteousness of God, then it starts from thankfulness. Thankfulness and praise to God is the greatest way in which we can honour him, arising out of our belief of God. We thank him and we praise him. And if we can retain that frame of mind, then surely we must view the judgment seat of God as something to be looked forward to. We approach it with joy and not with fear.